Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Little Atoms, tonight with me, Neil Denny, and I'm welcoming back to the show for the third time, Manjit Kumar. Manjit Kumar has degrees in physics and philosophy. He was a founding editor of Prometheus, an interdisciplinary journal that covered the arts and sciences, described by one reviewer as perhaps the finest magazine that I've ever read. He has written and reviewed for various publications, including The Guardian, The Times, The Independent and New Scientist. Manjit's book, Quantum, Einstein, Bohr and the Great Debate About the Nature of Reality, was shortlisted for the 2009 BBC Samuel Johnson Prize and was one of the top 10 science books of 2010 on Amazon.com. Manjit, welcome back to the show.
Pleased to be here.
So tonight we're going to be talking about something quite specific. It's today, 100 years ago today, was the end of the last day of the first Solvay conference. So first of all, before we actually talk about what that is and why it was set up, let's talk about why are we talking about this tonight? What does that actually mean to you?
Well, I mean, as you said, it's the 100th anniversary of the end of the first Solvay conference on the 4th of November 1911. What it means to me, it was the starting point of my book, Quantum, really. Many years ago, I was given a photograph of the 1927 conference, which was the fifth in the series of Solvay conferences that began in 1911. And it's a conference in where Albert Einstein and Niels Bohr began their great decades-long debate about the nature of quantum physics.
OK, so let's talk about Ernest Solvay. Who was he?
Ernest Solvay was a very rich Belgian industrialist who'd made a fortune by inventing and improving, later, the means of producing sodium carbonate. And apparently, and I say apparently because I don't know for sure, it's something that I researched, that apparently 70 plants worldwide still use the Solvay process. And so he was a very wealthy Belgian industrialist who had a panache for, you know, science. You know, he was a bit of an amateur scientist, liked physics and maths. And in 1910, he'd been approached by a Nobel Prize-winning chemist, German chemist, physical chemist, called Walter Nernst, about hosting a conference, a week-long conference, an elite conference, an invitation-only conference, to try and address some of the sort of pressing concerns that, you know, that physics was occupying the minds of physicists in, you know, 1910, 1911. And that's how the first Solvay conference sort of arose. And it's a quite interesting conference. It's a very iconic conference. I mean, 100 years later, you know, we see pictures of it in various physics histories, and you can Google it and you'll find loads, you know, it'll pop up on the internet and what have you. But in 1911, you know, Solvay was in his early 70s, rich guy, a bit of an amateur scientist. So, you know, he had the money. And Walter Nernst, he sort of drew up a list of people to invite. And what they really wanted to talk about was quantum physics. Mm-hmm. You know, the invitees included people like Albert Einstein, Max Planck, who discovered the quantum in 1900. Mary Curie was there. Ernest Rutherford, who on a previous program we talked about the fact that in March 1911 was the 100th, yeah, was when he came up with the whole idea of the nuclear atom. Mm-hmm. So he was there. But at the Solvay conference in 1911, he didn't talk about the so-called nuclear atom. They were there really to sort of address some of the sort of questions and issues that were being raised by quantum physics. Now, you've got to remember, in 1911 and 1910, when the conference was being proposed, not many people were particularly interested in quantum physics.
Sure.
You know, and even Max Planck was advising Walter Nernst in 1910, maybe it'd be better waiting a year or two, mm-hmm, before hosting a conference like this. And it was, a select invitee-only conference. I think there were about 20 people who actually showed up at the end. It was held in a very posh hotel called the Hotel Metropole in the heart of Brussels. All the invitees, you know, were paid 1,000 francs, which is a lot of money today, and you know, even though we're talking about the euros, 1,000 francs. And in 1911, you can imagine that was a quite tidy sum of money to be offered to come to a conference for 4 or 5 days, plus all their travelling expenses. And Einstein was quite keen on the conference, and he found it, as he said, I found the whole undertaking extremely attractive, even though later he called it a witch's Sabbath.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I mean, I've seen sort of conflicting accounts of this, but Einstein was, if not the youngest person that was attending, and certainly one of the couple of youngest scientists. So he was very much at the beginning of his, you know, Einstein wasn't the man he was to become at this point.
I'd qualify that slightly. He was certainly the youngest participant. Mm-hmm. Right, that's for sure. He wasn't the youngest present because sure. I think there was a younger physicist present, but he was serving as a scientific secretary.
This was de Broglie, was it?
No, it wasn't de Broglie. De Broglie there, that's who was the at the first conference, is Morris.
Okay.
Yeah, for your listeners, de Broglie was the chap who in 24 came up with the whole idea of wave particle duality, the idea that, you know, something like electron, which we all visualize as a billiard ball, could also have could also be waves. But the Broglie that's in the conference photograph and he was attending there was his elder brother, and it was his elder brother who actually got him interested in physics later on, because initially Louis has started off as a historian, right? And Einstein was a young gun, but by 1911 he was a professor of physics in Prague, mm-hmm. right? So he was no longer, by 1911, at the patent clerk in Bern, where he had been in 1905 when he put forward the special theory of relativity and he'd put forward the quantum theory of light, because the conference in 1911 really was addressing quantum physics, the latest ideas about, you know, that were beginning to emerge. And, you know, Einstein was very much at the forefront of that. He was, as I said before in a previous programme, the first person, I think, to learn to live with quantum ideas.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we can almost see the point in the history of quantum mechanics that this conference was held at in the title of the conference, because the theme of the conference is radiation in the quantum. It seems to be sort of coming more from Planck, the work of Planck. So perhaps we should just slightly, very quickly, set the scene and talk about what the sort of situation was in 1911, what the sort of prevailing scientific ideas were at that time.
Well, you've got to remember that, you know, there were many people in the early 1890s, so only 20 years earlier, who were saying, there's nothing left to discover of any substance in physics, you know, and all we've got to do is the next decimal place in terms of precise measurements. But, of course, by the end of the 1890s, there were X-rays, there was radioactivity, and the electron had been discovered. So all of these things have sent sort of experimenters and theorists, you know, the theorists to their blackboards and the experimenters to their labs to try and sort of unpick what was going on and try to understand it. And in 1900, Max Planck had come up with the idea of the quantum, you know, this idea that energy comes, you know, can come in packets. This is where the sort of phrase and the word quantum comes from. So instead of energy being sort of continuous, it interacted. He believed it didn't actually exist in bits. He only interacted in bits. It's like it was sliced and diced, you know. It was Einstein in 1905 who took the next step, which was to say that no, energy isn't sort of like somehow continuous, but only sort of interacts as if in bits and pieces in these quanta, these packets of energy, but that light, and therefore radiation, because obviously light is a part of the electromagnetic spectrum, at one end of which you have radio waves, and at the other end of which you have like X-rays and gamma rays, you know, from the long wavelength to the short, and that light's somewhere near in the middle. Einstein was saying that light and all radiation actually is made up of packets, and later on we had the word photons to describe particles of light. But in 1911, right, go back there, so we have the emergence of quantum theory, Planck's idea of the quantum. We have Einstein's quantum theory of light, which nobody likes, by the way, in 1911, because in 1911 the prevailing theory is the wave theory of light, because there's so much evidence to suggest that light's made up of waves, especially phenomena like interference and diffraction, that nobody takes Einstein seriously. And in 1911, as I just said earlier, Rutherford had already come up with the idea of the nuclear atom, the fact that you've got a positively charged centre around which, you know, a negatively charged particles, the electrons orbit, you know, the whole idea of a solar system, you know, miniature solar system. But no one was taking that seriously, including Rutherford himself, because What happens is that if you've got a charged particle like an electron orbiting a central nucleus, there are other theories in physics, electromagnetism, that says that it will spiral into the nucleus. So Rutherford's atom, Rutherford's nuclear atom, should collapse, and no one was taking it seriously. Rutherford didn't even mention it at the 1911 Solvay conference. And the Bohr atom, the idea that, you know, electrons occupy certain orbits and only certain orbits within atoms, that was a couple of years away still. So in 1911, even the structure of the atom wasn't still understood.
So what significant things did come out? What was talked about at this conference? Is there anything that significant actually came out of the 1911 conference?
Well, a couple of things. You know, Einstein did dismissively say later that it was like a witch's Sabbath and he learned nothing new. But he was, like I said, the one person who learned to live with the quantum, right? You know, Max Planck had already spent the best part of a decade to try and get rid of the quantum, you know, and he was also saying the time wasn't right maybe for a conference like this. But what happened was that, by its very nature, you know, a select elite group of physicists coming together to talk about quantum physics, you know, and classical physics and, you know, the relationship between the two, you know, the problems that needed to be solved. When the proceedings were later published, it drew attention of other physicists to some of the problems that these sort of, you know, Europe's leading physicists were discussing. So that was one thing. It sort of brought to, you know, the attention of other people when proceedings were published, you know, the ideas that these guys were debating. That was one thing. Secondly, now in 2011, 100 years later, conferences, there's loads of conferences. Physicists pick and choose which conferences that they need to go to, want to go to, but they're spoiled for choice in a sense. But in 1911, the first Solvay conference was pretty much the first international physics gathering to discuss certain issues. You know, because, you know, we take conferences for granted, but they didn't really exist back then. Mm-hmm. So even though, you know, you had seminal things like mathematicians gathering, you know, the Mathematicians' Congress, or you had a chemist gathering in the 1860s, you know, conferences were rather rare, and especially rare were an elite group coming together to discuss specific issues about ways forward and stuff like that. So it's significant in that sense.
I think before, in the second half of the show, we'll move on and look at the probably the more well-known fifth conference, 1927 conference. But before we do, one of the things that I think is remarkable when you look at the two photographs, you look at the list of attendees at these two things, there's actually the sort of personnel at both conferences is actually quite different. You know, there's a lot of new people coming in to the one in 1927. One of the people that's sort of omnipresent at both, that's actually quite striking, is Marie Curie. She's at both things. And this is like, I think we should almost, you know, not sort of forget the significance of this, as well as being, you know, the person that's won a Nobel Prize in two different disciplines. It's incredible to see a woman sat at in this photograph of, you know, 20 guys in suits with moustaches. It's quite that's quite a remarkable sight.
It is a remarkable sight. I mean, especially when you think about, you know, at this period, women graduating from universities was a very, very rare thing, right? You know, you know people like Lisa Meitner, you know, some of your listeners may not know, was, you know, instrumental in sort of unpicking and unearthing, you know, and understanding nuclear fission later. You know, she was sort of really struggling to sort of get university posts and things like that and being taken seriously. Now, Marie Curie, you know, to be perfectly honest, Marie Curie is at the 1911 conference, and she won her second Nobel Prize just before the conference. I think it was for chemistry. And she was the only, she was, at that time, I mean, of course, the Nobel Prize had already been in existence for about 10 or so years. She, you know, she's one of the few people still to have won two Nobel Prizes, and the only scientist to have won two Nobel Prizes in two different scientific disciplines. So there's an instance of there's a physicist who's won two Nobel Prizes, an American, John Bardeen, and I think Linus Pauling, you know, won a. He's a chemist who won two Nobel Prizes, one for chemistry, for work on the quantum theory and the chemical bond, but another one for the Nobel Prize for peace. So Marie Curie still remains unique in having won two Nobel Prizes for two different disciplines. However, her contributions to sort of understanding quantum physics, there are none. You know, she was there. I wouldn't say she was there as a token, but of course she made some sort of contribution to understanding of radioactivity and things like this. And of course, interesting enough, you know, as you say, that the 100th anniversary conference at the Solvay conference has only just recently finished, and I think there were only two women who were present at that one, and
so nothing changes, and not much changes.
No.
You're listening to Little Atoms today with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Manjit Kumar about the Solvay conference on the 100th anniversary of the end of the first Solvay conference in 1911. So as I said, let's move on and talk about the 1927 conference, the fifth conference, which I think is, you know, we could safely say is the most famous instance of this. So let's talk about who was there. What are they? You could just list off names of the people that were at this conference, and there are who's who of.
I mean, 16 years have passed. Yeah, it's going to, you know, you have 1911 first conference, and then you have the 1927 conference. 16 years have passed, but a lot has changed as well. Yeah. One significant thing about the 1927 conference, which some people forget, is that it was the first conference after the First World War. After the end of the First World War, it was the first conference to which scientists from Germany and Austria, from the Axis powers, were once again invited, you know, en masse, mm-hmm. and certainly German scientists. What happened after the First World War? Einstein had continued to be invited, but there were two conferences after the war before the third and the fourth mm-hmm. Took place after the war. Einstein couldn't make the third because he was in America, and on the fourth he decided not to attend because he believed that actually German scientists shouldn't be excluded because they shouldn't be held responsible for the actions of their government and stuff like this. Erwin Schrödinger, who people may know from famously from Schrödinger's cat, he was invited to the 1924 conference and he had gone. So the 1927 conference was important because the whole idea of science being international and the, you know, sort of the normalisation, if you like, relations with the German scientists, for example, who were invited. In fact, you can't have a conference in 1927 about electrons and photons, mm-hmm. right, which is what it was about, without German scientists, you know. So at the conference you had people like Werner Heisenberg, who people will know from the uncertainty principle. You know, Einstein obviously was there. You had Erwin Schrödinger from Schrödinger's cat. You had Paul Dirac, the British physicist, who people will be familiar with from antimatter or the theory of the theory of the electron. You had Max Born, another German physicist. You had Niels Bohr. Marie Curie was once again there. Max Planck was there. It was like a who's who of 20th century, first half of the 20th century. And it's a great photograph. It's, I've described it previously, you know, as when somebody's asked me about it, it's like having a picture of your favourite football team, you know, like an all-star 11. You know, they're all there, and that was what sparked my sort of desire to write Quantum when I came to write it, because what were all these people doing? What looked like in the photograph to be like a wet Monday morning in Brussels in 1927, and they were there to debate, you know, the developments that happened in quantum physics.
So by this point as well, of course, we're talking about it's a number of years later after the first 1911. So quantum physics itself has become the preeminent, you know, theory. It's taken over from sort of more classical physical theories as being, you know, the preeminent theory for the best explanation for the microscopic level of nature. So let's perhaps talk about what's happened in those interim years to put it into the sort of pole position now that it's at in 27.
Well, okay, what happens in 1913, we have Bohr. Niels Bohr has developed a quantum theory of the atom. What I mean by that is that he's managed to fix Rutherford's atom. So the atom is still a central nucleus with electrons going around it. But Bohr, how he's fixed it is by just prescribing. He says, you know what, electrons won't crash into the nucleus because they can only occupy certain orbits, and in those orbits they don't lose energy and they don't crash into the nucleus, right? So that's what he basically says, and he's got a bit of mathematics to back all of that up. But what happens, it allows him to explain a whole bunch of data. There's things called spectra, atomic spectra, which are like negatives of things, you know, they're like photos of light being emitted by particular atoms, if you think about it. So, for example, hydrogen and helium and carbon and oxygen, all the elements in the periodic table, if you were able to photograph the light they emitted, they would be a series of lines, but each is unique to that particular element. Now, Bohr later said to try to explain that was a bit like trying to explain, you know, the patterns on the wings of a butterfly. Mm-hmm. You know, that was sort of, you know, the sort of analogy he sort of drew. It was as difficult as that. But what he found is by assuming this, that the fact that, you know, electrons could only occupy certain positions and the whole quantum leap, that if they went from one orbit to another, as they jumped up or down, they would either absorb or emit packets of light, that if you were photographed these, that these would match up with the sort of lines of light that you get, these fingerprints of light. So because he was able to explain that, they gave it a lot more. You know, that was it wasn't a clincher, but it was a real solid sort of evidence in favour of it. So that was in 1913, right? By the mid-20s, quantum physics, quantum ideas had been bolted onto classical ideas. So you had a problem that you needed to try and solve in physics. You know, sometimes what you try to do is, you know, you have a classical sort of approach, the approach of the 19th century physicists, if you like, and then you sort of add on, you know, sort of quantum ideas to try and sort of explain it and solve it. So it was all a bit of a hodgepodge, you know. And by the mid-1920s, people were getting quite embarrassed about it because there was no sort of overarching sort of structure, a logical structure, the sort of structure that was given to classical physics by Newton's laws of motion. You know, Newton's three laws of motion plus gravity helped sort of give sort of classical physics a solid foundation, you know, from which everything else would have emerged. And there was nothing like that for quantum physics until 1925, 26, when instead of one quantum theory, Werner Heisenberg developed one called matrix mechanics, Erwin Schrödinger developed another called wave mechanics. So that was in 25, 26, and in 20, a year or so earlier, the whole idea of wave-particle duality had come up. So between the two conferences, you know, there is now a quantum mechanics, which didn't exist in 1911. In 1911, there was quantum theory, but it wasn't really a theory. It was like quantum ideas being used and bolted on to try and explain various phenomena. So now, by 1927, you have a real theory. And the significance of the conference is that Niels Bohr feels that he can now explain what quantum physics is all about and what it says about the nature of atomic and subatomic reality. And the one person who hasn't heard his ideas, because he'd already presented them a month earlier at a conference in Italy, is Albert Einstein. Einstein had refused to set foot in Italy, so Einstein arrives in Brussels, you know, as, if you like, if Bohr at this stage is the king of the quantum, because he has an institute in Copenhagen, Einstein is still very much the Pope of physics. And Bohr and Einstein, are, you know, have a very friendly relationship. You know, they've met each other, you know, a few times, very cordial, very friendly relationship. And Bohr is also desperate to trying to convince the most famous physicist since Newton that he's right. Now, you ask what's changed between 1911 and 1927. One of the things that's also changed is in 1919, the British expedition confirmed some of the predictions made by Einstein's general theory of relativity, and that catapults Einstein not only from a celebrity and a star physicist in the community of physicists, it makes him a global celebrity overnight, as, you know, newspapers sort of start, you know, like the Times in London start saying, you know, German scientist sort of knocks Newton off his pedestal and things like that. So 1927 is important because it's a conference in where they've gathered together, they try to understand what quantum physics is saying. Most people agree with Bohr. Einstein is hearing Bohr's ideas, if you like, live for the first time. Mm-hmm. People like Heisenberg and Schrödinger, they're all making presentations, and a lot of the discussions take place outside of the formal sort of sessions, and it's a debate that begins there, but then lasts into the for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, you know, so Einstein basically fundamentally disagrees, and that sets up what's subsequently become to be called the Einstein-Bohr debates that go on for I think about 20 years after that. But I've also heard this described as this debate has been described as the struggle between scientific realists and instrumentalists. What does that mean?
We got 5 minutes. Now you've decided to sort of get complicated. Well, just very, very briefly, Niels Bohr, and this is adopted a position vis-a-vis quantum physics and what we're saying about the nature of reality that became known later, not at the time, but later, as the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics. It was the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics because Bohr, since the early 20s, had been the head of a physics institute in Copenhagen, which had attracted some of the brightest and the best in terms of the next generation of physicists. People like Werner Heisenberg had spent time there, Pauli had spent time there, Paul Dirac had spent time there, they'd all sort of spent time there. And so Bohr's interpretation, if you like, became known as Copenhagen. Now, what Bohr believed is this, just to sort of, in a nutshell, imagine you have a particle in a box, say an electron, and you wanted to know its position. Now, Bohr would say there is no particle in that box with a position until you do an experiment to measure its position. Right? Einstein would say, well, there is a particle in that box. I might not know where it is until I do an experiment, but there's certainly a particle in the box, you know. And so they were like these two different positions. So Einstein was a realist in the sense that he believed, in another famous phrase that he used later, was, does the moon, or a question he posed later, does the moon exist if I'm not looking at it? So Einstein believed that the moon did exist when he didn't look at it. So there is a reality that's independent of the observer, and it's the job of the scientist to sort of pull back that reality and investigate it. Bohr, on the other hand, believed that there was no independent observer-independent reality. So, you know, that's where the instrumentalism comes in terms of the Copenhagen-Bohr position, because he believes, you know, when you do an experiment to measure its position, ho presto, that's what you get. You get the position of the electron. But prior to that measurement, there ain't really one.
Okay, well, we're virtually out of time, but we're talking now about a conference that was taking place in 1927. We've just been talking before about how the 25th conference has just been held. There's been conferences roughly, on average, every 3 or 4 years ever since then. Can you, in the last minute of the show, perhaps summarise what's happened, anything significant that's happened at every other conference between the 5th one and the 25th one?
Well, I would say that, you know, between the 5th and the 25th, it would be the 6th conference in 1930 would be my favourite one. Because, as I said, you know, the 1911 Subway Conference was conferences were rare then. Now, even though we've had a conference to commemorate the 100th anniversary, you know, there's plenty of conferences. They don't hold the same significance as they did before. You can have Nobel conferences, you know, getting together, Nobel laureates and stuff like that. In 1930, that was the second round of the Einstein-Bohr debate. Once again, it was another 4 or 5, 6 day-long conference in Brussels. Again, took place at the same time of year. But it was 3 years later. Whereas everybody had thought that Einstein had lost the Einstein-Bohr debate in 1927, Einstein came back in 1930 with a thought experiment involving, I haven't got time, but a thought experiment involving a box of light, which he unleashed on Bohr. It was an imaginary thought experiment, and believed he could circumvent Bohr's interpretation of what was happening. Bohr looked at it initially over breakfast and thought, Einstein's right. He seems to have, you know, succeeded here. And people who were there said that he looked like a dog who'd taken a thrashing from his master. So it's it's one of my favourite ones, because at the end of the day, what happens, Einstein actually loses that debate, right, because Bohr comes up in that phase of the debate, because Bohr comes up with a counter-argument. And the counter-argument involves Einstein forgetting his own theory of relativity. He was so keen to sort of, you know, demolish the Copenhagen interpretation that he forgot his seminal contribution to physics.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. So I've been talking to Manjit Kumar about the 100th anniversary of the Solvay Conference. Manjit, thanks for coming on Little Atoms again.
Pleasure.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.